Good evening, and welcome to tonight's event. My name is Justin Wojak, and I am the president of Princeton Faith in Action. On behalf of all those in attendance tonight, I would like to sincerely thank Professor Singer and Mr. D'Souza for their being here with us and for their enthusiasm about tonight's topic. I would also like to thank those who helped plan this event and for our sponsors, Christian Union and the Fixed Point Foundation, who have made this event possible. It is our hope that tonight's event stimulates engaging and thoughtful conversation about this important subject across our campus. Now let me introduce our moderator this evening, our very own Professor Eric Gregory of the Religion Department at Princeton. Having been educated at Harvard, Oxford, and Yale, Professor Gregory finally made it to Princeton in 2001. In 2007, he was awarded the Princeton's President's Award for Distinguished Teaching. I myself am fortunate to have a class with him this semester, and we are fortunate to have him as our moderator this evening.
Friends, let me add my welcome to you and my thanks to Justin and our sponsors for tonight's exciting debate between Peter Singer and Dinesh D'Souza. It perhaps may be the most exciting debate of a fall full of debates. And my task as moderator is to keep us on time. So let me invite you, as they say at the movies, a second time to please turn off your cell phones and perhaps at this point gently remind you of the best of Princeton's traditions of public dialogue, spirited inquiry, and mutual respect. Our topic is, can there be morality without God? A question that admits many possible senses, and we leave it to our speakers to define the terms in their response. The format is as follows. Each speaker will be given a 15-minute opening statement, followed by 5 minutes of rebuttal and 5 minutes of cross-examination for each speaker. We will then open the floor to questions, which will be solicited on note cards found in the program and collected after the opening statements. Each speaker will have 3 minutes for a closing statement, and we will wrap things up about 10:15 with the question resolved, or perhaps better questions raised, and just in time for the students to go back to the library. Our distinguished speakers are prolific, provocative, and influential. They are widely acclaimed, both inside and outside the academy. Peter Singer is the Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics at the University Center for Human Values here at Princeton University, a position he has held since 1999. He was educated at the University of Melbourne and the University of Oxford. Professor Singer was the founding president of the International Association of Bioethics and founding co-editor of the journal Bioethics. He first became internationally known after the publication of Animal Liberation in 1975. His many other books include Practical Ethics, How Are We to Live?, Rethinking Life and Death, One World, The President of Good and Evil, and The Way We Eat, Why Our Food Choices Matter. His newest book, The Life You Can Save, Acting Now to End World Poverty, will be published in March. Dinesh D'Souza is a former scholar at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Before joining the Hoover Institution, Mr. D'Souza was the John M. Olin Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. In 1987, he served as senior policy analyst at the Reagan White House. He graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Dartmouth College in 1983. And Mr. D'Souza's many books include the New York Times bestsellers What's So Great About America, and his 1991 book, Illiberal Education. His latest book is titled, What's So Great About Christianity? We begin with Professor Singer.
Thank you very much, Eric, for that introduction. I'd like to thank Princeton Faith in Action, Christian Union and Fixed Point Foundation as well for making this event possible. I'm speaking here tonight because I think that it's important that universities should discuss the big issues, and certainly this is one of those big issues. Can there be morality without God? And I want to focus for a moment on that question, that we are discussing that particular question, whether there can be morality without God. We are not discussing any particular set of moral views held by any particular atheist, and that includes the views that I hold. I mention this, you might think I needn't be that specific, because there was a press release circulated by the Christian Union a few days ago which referred to an earlier debate that Dinesh D'Souza and I had had on a different topic, and then stated, "The Princeton debate promises to be even more heated as the topic is deliberately framed to focus attention on Singer's controversial views on ethics and morality." Well, I have to say that was news to me, and I think that if that's what you're here for, you might leave now. Because it's obvious that that wouldn't answer the question that we're talking about. In other words, you can't argue Peter Singer's morality is the morality of an atheist. Peter Singer's morality is indefensible. Therefore, the morality of atheists is indefensible in general. That would be just like arguing Osama bin Laden's morality is the morality of a theist. Osama bin Laden is a theist. Therefore, the morality of theists is indefensible. Neither is a valid argument. So I want to focus on the particular question that we are discussing without getting distracted by issues about whether views that I hold are or are not right. If Faith in Action or Christian Union want to come back and organise a debate some other time specifically about my views, I'll be happy to do that. That's not what we're doing tonight. What we are doing tonight is to discuss the issue that is often summed up in the contention famously put forward by Ivan Karamazov in Dostoevsky's The Karamazov Brothers, where he said, actually he didn't exactly say this, it isn't a quote, but it is a reasonable summary, if there is no God, everything is permitted. So I want to say, well, should we believe that? Why should we believe that? Why would anyone think, for example, consider any of the atrocities that we have sadly had to witness in this century, young as it still is? Think about 9/11, think about Darfur, or about the Congo, what's been happening there, or more recently, just very recently, fresh in our memories, what happened in Mumbai. And ask yourself, well, if there were no God, would all that be permitted? One question that you might occur to you then is, well, what do you mean? Permitted by whom? So, obviously, these actions, these atrocities, are not permitted by law in any nation, as far as I'm aware, these sorts of things. And even now internationally, we have a developing body of international law. We have an international criminal court, which exists to make sure that even where these things, these crimes are not prosecuted in the country in which they're committed, that they are against international law and that people can be tried in the international criminal court, despite the best efforts of the professedly Christian administration of this country over the last 8 years to undermine the status of the International Criminal Court and to refuse to be part of it. So these things are not permitted by law, but of course we're not really talking about law, we're talking about morality. You might say, if you're a theist, that such acts are prohibited by God, and if there's no God, well, obviously they're permitted. Well, certainly it's true that if you're an atheist, you can't say they're prohibited by God. But first, the fact that some theists can say that some acts are prohibited by God doesn't make it true that they are. And if there is no God, then it's obviously also not true that they're prohibited by God. That statement is false. So I'm just going to take 1 minute of my time, perhaps, to say why I think they can't be prohibited by God, because there isn't a God in the sense of a God in the Judeo-Christian tradition. There are other gods about which perhaps I might have other doubts, but the God of the Judeo-Christian tradition is supposed to be a God who is omniscient, omnipotent, and omnibenevolent, all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good. And if you look at the world around us, indeed, if you look at some of the very events that I've been describing, I don't think there could be such a God in this world, because such a God would not permit these events to take place. Now, if you might say, well, these events that I've described occur through human free will, and for some reason that's a greater good than the evils that humans commit, that still doesn't resolve the problem, because there's also immense suffering that occurs without any intervention of human free will. For example, people die not only because they're killed by other humans, but they die in droughts, and they die in floods, and they die in earthquakes. And often these people are innocent of any conceivable sin, because perhaps they're a year old, and they die slow, lingering deaths. And it's hard to see how that can be justified or defended by free will. And even if, although I think this is a repellent doctrine, you were to say they suffer because they too have original sin, since they are descended from Adam and Eve, as indeed some Christians would say, we still have the insoluble problem of the suffering of non-human animals who are not descended from Adam and Eve, do not take part in original sin, and yet suffer slow, lingering deaths in droughts and famines and earthquakes, just as humans do. So I think there is no reconciliation of the existence of that kind of suffering and the kind of God of the Christian and Jewish traditions. So I think that it's not a good argument to say that these things are not permitted because God prohibits them, because you would need to defend the idea that such a God exists. So I think that the question, can there be morality without God, really comes to a question of, can there be morality given that we are in a universe without God? But of course, we can suspend our disbelief in God and ask questions about what difference would it make to morality if there were a God. So let's again then ask, why would one think that these acts that I mentioned, that I'm sure we all think and I think are morally wrong, would not be morally wrong if there were a God? And I'm going to mention three claims that people might make in defense of this. So the first claim is that the very concepts I'm using, the expressions right or wrong, even good or bad, would be meaningless if there were no God. They only have meaning in a universe with God because what they really mean, good and something we're obliged to do, mean right, that God wills them. And conversely, that something is wrong or bad, we ought not to do it, means that God wills that they not exist or that they not be done. So we have a meaning to the words through God's will and God's commands. This is a famous position, but also one that has been famously refuted right in the early stages of Western philosophy in Plato's Euthyphro, where essentially the argument was, so what about these things that I've talked about, say? Obviously Plato wasn't talking about those things, but what about these things? Are they only wrong because God says they are wrong? Or does God condemn them? Does God command that we not do them because they are wrong? And I think that's very puzzling for the person who defends the view that there is no meaning to right or wrong without the existence of God. Because if you say that they're only wrong because God wills them or wills the good, condemns the bad, then you're essentially saying that God could have willed the opposite. God could have willed that we drop bombs on villages consisting entirely of civilians. God could have willed that we hack off the limbs of children in order to carry out our civil war in the Congo or in Darfur. And that would have been the right thing to do if God had willed it. And you can't say God wouldn't have willed it because it would have been wrong, because on this conception, there is no meaning to it being wrong except that God wills it. So that doesn't seem a very plausible position to take. We really have to take the view that these things would have been wrong, that God, if you like, if you believe in God, condemned them because they were wrong of their nature, of their intrinsic nature. But then you have to admit that there is a meaning to the concept, at least, of right and wrong, independent of God's command. God doesn't give that term meaning, it has meaning prior to him. So the first claim, I think, does not survive that argument. The second claim sometimes made is, we can't know what is right or wrong without God's revelation to guide us. So yes, the terms have meaning, but we would be lost. We would be at sea, not able to separate right from wrong. Well, if there were a God, and if he had revealed his will about what is right or wrong, in clear and indisputable language that we could all accept, then perhaps you could run this line. Then perhaps you could say, God did reveal to us what is right or wrong. But he did not do that. It's quite extraordinary how often religious people refer to some sacred text as if it were the source of all moral knowledge, and then ignore half, the inconvenient half, of course, of what it actually says. And we have plenty of examples of that in the Christian world today, including in this country. For we're living in a society in which most people, anyway, say that they are Christian. And yet, they ignore the repeated insistence of Jesus in the Gospels that everyone, and especially the rich, should give to the poor. You remember that bit of it? You remember when he told the rich man, sell all your possessions and give them to the poor? In case you didn't get the message, he went on to say, it's as hard for a rich man to go to heaven as a camel to go through the eye of a needle. That sounds like it's not a good policy to remain rich if you want to go to heaven, doesn't it? Yet there's lots of rich Christians still in this country. That's a bit of the gospel that they don't really seem to want to follow. And there's lots of other injunctions, for example, many of them in the same course. He urged those who give feasts to invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, and the blind. Most of you probably had a feast last Thursday. Hands up, those who invited the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind. Don't see a lot of hands. I see one or two hands. Very good. Congratulations. That's excellent. That's nice to see. But there's about 800 people in this room, and I saw a dozen or so hands, maybe. So I think that we are not actually getting our guidance. People, Christians generally, do not follow. They choose selectively which bits of the Bible they want to follow. Consider what Jesus is reported to have said about divorce. Divorce, he said, either is just wrong altogether, depending which bit of the Gospels you read, or it's only permitted on the grounds of adultery. There's not many Christians, there are some, but there's not many Christians who adhere to that. Even fewer adhere to the idea that to marry a divorced woman is itself to commit adultery. Don't know a lot of Christians who refuse to marry a divorced woman. Not a divorced man, apparently, by the way. Not too sure exactly what the basis of that distinction is. On the other hand, Christians in this country seem to think that they have a lot of guidance from God in Christianity about views about abortion, about the use of obtaining stem cells from embryos, about homosexuality. There's no clear guidance in the Gospels anyway, in the New Testament, about that. People may say, well, it's not just the New Testament, we go to the Old Testament as well. But once you go to the Old Testament, you find a lot of amazing things that God is supposed to have said and commanded, and your job of working out which ones you want to follow is more difficult than ever. For example, God explicitly advocates genocide in the Old Testament. not passages probably very often read in church, but look at Numbers 31, where God commands the Israelites to wreak his vengeance on the Midianites. And when they go there and destroy their villages and kill their cattle and slaughter the men, they bring back to Moses the women and the children. And Moses is angry. Moses said, "Why have you spared the women and the children? Go and kill them. Go and kill all the women who have known men by lying with them. And kill all the boys. But the girls who haven't known men, keep them for yourselves." Is that where you want to take your moral guidance from? I don't think so. So the scriptures that we have are not guidance to moral thinking. If we want to use them, we have to use our own judgment. We have to sort out for ourselves what's right and wrong. And that's what we're doing anyway, whether we take the scriptures as a sacred text or just take them as an interesting work of literature to discuss and think about. 2 minutes? Thank you. Okay. So let me move to the third claim. The third claim is that even though the terms right and wrong make sense, and even though we can find out what is right and wrong, nevertheless, people won't do it. This is perhaps what Ivan actually had in mind in the Karamazov brothers, because one thing he actually does say, this is a quote, "If there is no immortality, there is no virtue." Now, I admit it would be nice to believe that all the virtuous are going to be rewarded in an afterlife and all the wicked are going to be punished in an afterlife. And it would be even better, of course, if people believed that and acted in their long-term self-interest so that they didn't do things that they believed to be wrong because of this concern about punishment. But it actually doesn't seem to work. It's quite an interesting sociological fact. Of course, I think it's difficult to believe in the first place for reasons that I've spelled out. But it doesn't really seem to work. That is, when we compare more Christian countries with less Christian countries, like this one, for example, with European countries that have a lower level of religious belief and observance, we find that many of the things that Christians condemn, are actually more common here. Murder is more common in this country. We have a higher prison rate. And incidentally, some statistics I saw, a little bit dated, suggested that the number of atheists in prison was less than 1%, whereas of the prison population, whereas in the population as a whole, it's regarded as being perhaps 5, 8, 10%, considerably disproportionately small number of atheists in prison. Maybe they're just clever and don't get caught, of course. Let's go on. Abortion rates, teenage pregnancy rates, they're also higher in this country. Juvenile, we also don't look after despite the injunctions I talked about, we don't look after the poor as well in this country as we do in Europe. We have higher rates of poverty and we have less social support for those who are in poverty. And then, of course, we have the mystery of the various religious people, both evangelicals and Catholic priests, who are constantly talking about sin, constantly emphasizing sexual sins in particular, and are constantly committing them. Well, it's puzzling, isn't it, that if they believe in punishment in the afterlife, this doesn't seem to help them to control their urges, which we all have and which are sometimes difficult to control. But it doesn't seem to be successful in helping them to urge it. So I would say that none of these grounds, just sort of one more point, none of these grounds really would help us to believe in a morality without God. So I'm sure Dinesh is going to say that I've said a lot of negative things, but I haven't said anything about what ethics is. So I think since I'm out of time now, but I do have some time coming up after Dinesh has spoken, I'm going to say, hold on, you will get the answer to that question after we've heard from Dinesh.
Dinesh D'Souza.
I want to say how pleased and delighted I am to be here. I didn't go to Princeton. I went to Dartmouth, and I must say I was a little bit of a rebel when I was a student there. I edited a conservative campus newspaper that was a kind of thorn in the side of the Dartmouth administration, and we used to tell the deans that taking on our rebel paper was a bit like wrestling with a pig. Not only did it get everyone dirty, but the pig liked it. And It is in that spirit that I come here to tussle with Peter Singer, you might say, on his home turf, Princeton University. It falls to me to have the task, since Peter Singer, I think for understandable reasons, does not want to discuss his views. And so it is going to be, I guess, my task to discuss them. But not in the mode of arguing that this is proof that atheism doesn't work. Rather, I want to discuss Peter Singer's work as the effort of a very rare and gifted man attempting to develop, you might say, a truly secular morality, working out the consequences of what could be called true secularism. Now, why is this important? This is important because many of us think we live in secular culture. Hey, Princeton University is a secular campus. But right away, in this building itself, we have some clues that that's not entirely true. Princeton wasn't founded as a secular institution. It has ideas and institutional frameworks and codes that are very much derivative of its Christian origins. And in some senses, you may say it is subsisting on capital derived from its own unique theological and intellectual and educational history. We say Europe is secular, but if you walk around Europe, you find yourself drenched in Christian institutions, Christian monuments, Christian cathedrals, Christian symbols, and arguably the culture of Europe, even the culture that secularists and atheists champion, is in fact powerfully shaped by Christian assumptions, sometimes hidden Christian assumptions. So what I would like to do, if I may, is I want to begin with just a quote or two from Peter Singer, because I want to then expound a little bit later on the meaning of these quotes. He says, for example, that if we compare a severely defective human infant with a non-human animal, a dog or a pig, for example, we will often find the non-human to have superior capacities, both actual and potential, for rationality, self-consciousness, communication, and so on. What he's really getting at here is that we give to infants and sick people, particularly the mentally handicapped, rights. And his point is, why do we? We don't give the same rights to, well, he says right here, he says, we don't give the same rights to pigs and chickens. He says the calf, the pig, and the much-derided chicken come out ahead of the newly born infant in terms of sentience, comprehension, perhaps anticipating the future. Now, frankly, I find all of this a little disturbing, in part because I had chicken for lunch. And when I read this, it made me feel a bit like a cannibal. But what Peter Singer's getting at here is, in a sense, rights do not accrue because we are human. And for this reason, he says, and I want to quote him so I'm not getting him wrong. He says, in our book, Should the Baby Live?, my colleague Helga Kusi and I suggested that a period of 28 days after birth might be allowed before an infant is accepted as having the same right to life as others. The point he's trying to get at is he's not discussing abortion. He's saying that an infant, perfectly healthy, in essentially the first month after birth, has no rights and can be killed for any reason, or any good reason, perhaps. Now, in some senses, when I say this to people, they sometimes say, Peter Singer, he's a provocateur. He's just saying things to get people going and so on. I want to argue that this actually is unfair to Peter Singer and what he is trying to do. In some ways, what he's trying to do is very different than a lot of other, I've been debating several other of the so-called new atheists. Christopher Hitchens, the biologist, Richard Dawkins, and so on. And to a man, what those guys say is something like this. Sure, we can be moral without God. You don't need God to have morality. Because if Christians can do good stuff, be honest, kind, just, do charity, atheists can too. If there's a big famine in Rwanda tomorrow, the Christian can shed a tear, volunteer his or her time, write a check. But the new atheists say, well, we can do that too. God is superfluous. You don't have to believe in God in order to be moral. Now, on the surface, this, I think, is correct. I would not argue for a moment that Christians have any kind of monopoly on virtue or that atheists are not capable of it. But I think what it misses is it misses a deeper point. And that is that even if you make a list of all the values that secular people or atheists cherish, if you read the books of the New Atheists, they say, we believe in the idea of the individual. We believe in the autonomy of science. We believe in the equal dignity of women. We believe in the worth of human life. We believe in compassion as a social virtue. And my point is, okay, but these values came into the West, and in some cases into the world, because of Christianity. How do we know this? It's pretty simple. First of all, we look at other cultures. Peter Singer mentioned a great famine. If there was a great famine in Rwanda tomorrow, you'd notice something rather interesting. All the Western countries would immediately rally, Doctors Without Borders, the Red Cross, missionaries, and so on. And in other cultures, China, India, there would be a kind of great silence. Why? When I grew up in India, we learned a proverb that says, in effect, that tears of strangers are only water. The basic idea here is you look after people when they are your people. But if someone is nothing to you, you wish them well, but you have no obligation to them. This idea of universal brotherhood is, in effect, a Christian idea. Consider the idea of the value of human life. You wouldn't find that value very powerfully present in ancient Greece or Rome before Christianity. The Spartans, we all know, would take the sick or defective child and stick it on the hillside and be perfectly happy to find it dead in the morning. Peter Singer cites such facts to, in a sense, recommend them, to say, hey, look, what the ancient Greeks and Romans did, what the Bushmen of the Kalahari do, we should reconsider. We should bring back into our civilization. Consider the idea of compassion. Aristotle makes a list of the virtues. Compassion never appears on that list. In fact, elsewhere in Aristotle, compassion is treated more as a vice. So how did compassion become, if you will, the central political virtue of Western civilization? It became that because of Christianity. Well, consider the idea of equal rights, which I take it pretty much everyone in this room believes in, the equal dignity of women, the abolition of slavery. The fact is, slavery is a universal institution. We find it in China, in India, in ancient Greece and Rome, in Africa. There were slaves in the Americas long before Columbus got here. Anti-slavery, the movement to contest slavery, is uniquely Christian, and in some senses developed only in one civilization and not elsewhere. In fact, for many, many millennia, slavery needed no defenders because it had no critics. It was like the family, taken for granted. So how did slavery become controversial? Well, first of all, many people think that slavery was abolished only in the modern era. Not true. Slavery was mostly abolished in Europe between the 4th century and the 10th century. Replaced by serfdom, to be sure, which is not exactly a walk in the park. But at least it isn't being owned by some other guy. And then in the modern era, Christians began to take a theological proposition: we are created equal in the eyes of God. And derive from it a political corollary. Since we are created equal in the eyes of God, no man has the right to rule another man without his consent. And this idea becomes the basis not only of anti-slavery or abolition, it also becomes the basis of democracy. Because modern democracy, if you think about it, is based on the simple notion that no man, no person has the right to rule another without consent. So the point I'm trying to get at here is that much of what we call secular morality is itself standing, you might say, on a Christian pedestal. And all you have to do is probe it a little. Even Peter Singer's morality, I will show, has rooted in it Christian assumptions that he seems unwilling or reluctant to acknowledge. And I want to make a second point. Morality is a fact in the world. It's real. I'm not just talking, by the way, about the morality of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. When faced with the choice of two evils, always choose the one you haven't tried before. That's not the 10, that's Mae West. Anyway, the point I'm making is we have all these moral codes. We have all these moral codes. And the question becomes, can these moral codes be understood better if you assume that there is a God or if you assume that there isn't a God? In other words, does morality require what can be called a transcendental foundation? Or can you explain morality, you might say, in purely secular terms? Let's consider the secular explanation, which is, in effect, we are evolved Darwinian primates. That's what we are, and that is all that we are. And I ask you, what sense does this make of morality? If we are evolved Darwinian primates, we are driven by an imperative to survive, to reproduce, to, you may say, acquire power, to consolidate our position in the world and in nature. And we do all those things. That's the Darwinian side of us. But I think everyone in this room knows that there is another side, not only to us, but in us, that not only seems inexplicable on the Darwinian account, but it seems to actively subvert and defy the Darwinian account. I'll give a simple example so everyone knows exactly what I mean. Let's say I'm walking on the riverbank, and I hear someone shout, "Help, help, help, I'm drowning." My initial instinct is to look over and see the guy flailing around in the water. I notice that he weighs 250 pounds. I notice also that I'm not a very good swimmer. And I feel this powerful Darwinian imperative to keep going. I ask myself, is this my brother? Is it a relative? Is someone I care about? No, it's a total stranger. I've never seen that guy in my life. Why on earth should I risk anything to help that guy? Keep going, Dinesh. But the moment I take steps forward to keep going, a little lamp lights on in my head and another voice, not mine, begins to speak against this and say, in effect, Dinesh, that's not right. You should try to help the guy. At least give him a stick and pull him to the shore. Of course, my Darwinian voice fires back and says, in effect, "No, what are you talking about? The guy weighs 250 pounds. Is it more likely you'll pull him out or he'll pull you in?" In other words, why take the chance? But if I keep going, if I listen, you may say, to my Darwinian instinct, I feel this powerful sense of qualms and anxiety and frustration. There is, in a sense, the unavoidable sense that I'm doing something wrong. It is almost as if it's not just a feeling, it's not just a reason, it is almost as if, you may say, there is a transcendental voice that is speaking within me that has no power to coerce me, but has every power, in a sense, to establish an ineradicable standard that even I, try as I may, cannot resist paying attention to. My question is, where does this transcendental, powerful sense that is within us, where does that come from? What is its Darwinian foundation? The bottom line is, I'm saying that whether or not we disagree on the margin about this morality or that morality, we all know that as human beings, we are moral creatures. And by moral creatures, what I mean is we have moral standards. Standards that we did not create. Now, we may not live up to those standards. Peter Singer's right about that. But that proves absolutely nothing. It simply means the standards are better than us. Quite frankly, if we devise them, most likely we would not devise standards that we could not live up to. The fact is, we embrace standards, you may say, that set a bar that none of us can fully jump over or scale. Now, in some senses, this idea that we are Darwinian primates can generate an attempt to create, you might say, secular morality. One reason I'm interested in Professor Singer's work is he says very clearly, he says, many of the things that we take for granted, for example, take the idea that human life is sacred. He says, that is not, if you will, morality, that's Christian morality. He says, man is on a Darwinian continuum with the beasts. We're not special. We're no different. He goes, but what Christianity has done and what man has done more generally is take Homo sapiens and put him on this pedestal and assign to him special protections and special rights, which are, at, you may say, while demeaning the rest of creation. sort of the biblical idea that the rest of creation is now man's to use for his instrumental purposes. And what Singer says is that once we realize that God is dead, we've got to reverse all this. We cannot do what the new atheists want to do. The new atheists want to kill God, but keep Christian values of liberty, equality, compassion, and so on. And Singer Singh can't do it. If you want to kill God, there goes human dignity. There goes the idea of the specialness of human beings. There goes the idea of human rights. Why he's working at an institute for human values, I have no idea. But nevertheless. Now, the point I want to make is this. If we want to look at what secular morality really is, if we want to see if Dostoevsky is right, if God is not, everything is permitted, we cannot look to Belgium or France. We have to look really to the communist regimes of the 20th century. Efforts to really, you might say, purge Christianity, shut down the churches, kill all the priests, establish the new man and the new utopia, liberated from the shackles of traditional religion and traditional morality. And when you look at the body count of those atheist regimes, by the way, a body count that would make a bin Laden blush, even a junior league atheist like Pol Pot in Indochina managed to kill about 2 million people in the short space of 3 years. So atheism, you might say, not religion, is responsible for the mass murders of history. Peter Singer, when he advocates infanticide, when he advocates euthanasia, and when in the same breath he advocates animal rights, he puzzles some people, but he is really, in a sense, thinking through the implications of atheism. He's saying if you remove God, man comes down from the pedestal and the natural continuum with the animals is restored. I know that because Singer has advocated the killing of infants and so on, the killing of the handicapped, some people have said he's a Nazi. And he has protested this and said, this is ridiculous, I'm not a Nazi. And I think in a way he's right. Because the Nazis advocated, you might say, state-sponsored genocide. What Peter Singer advocates is actually something very different. Private sector homicide. In other words, don't make the government do it. You do it. Now, I cite Singer's work not to prove atheism or God, but to show you that secularism, when you really remove the religious presuppositions, is a little bit of a frightening idea. We might be moving in that direction, but if we do, the next time you have someone over for dinner, just make sure to count your spoons. Thank you very much.
We move on now to the rebuttals, starting with Peter Singer, who will have 5 minutes.
Thank you. Yes, we are Darwinian primates. We are, that is, primates who have evolved from other primates. I think that's established scientifically. Dinesh doesn't deny it, as I understand his position. Do we have to believe that there is some transcendental spark that is contrary to the evolutionary account in order to explain why we have morality and why we behave as we do, and why occasionally heroic people jump in and save heavy, drowning strangers, although also very often they don't? I don't think we do need any such account. I think we can explain the existence of compassion, concern for others, in the way we have evolved as mammals, as beings who've had to take care of their own children, as beings who've lived in small communities where we're often related to other members of the community and want to save them and support them, and that helps the survival of our genes as well. And of course, as social beings who live in communities that reciprocate, as indeed our close primate relatives do as well. We're not unique in this. And form reciprocal bonds. And there's a lot of research that suggests that the best strategy in these conditions is, at least initially, to help strangers. And only if it turns out that they are not going to help you do you then cease to help them or even pay them back for the bad deeds they do you. The simple ethic known as tit for tat works quite well in game theory that models evolution. So it's possible to explain why we do some of the rescues we do in those ways. Some people perhaps have this to a stronger degree than others and therefore are more likely to do the rescues. What's completely compatible with the Darwinian account and is not explained by the idea of a transcendental light turning on that we need to save strangers because of our belief in the sanctity of human life is precisely what I talked about before when I talked about our failure to follow the teachings of Jesus as reported in the Gospels about the rich people giving to the poor. We don't do that. We have 1 billion people living in extreme poverty in the world today, living on a dollar or so a day. We have 27,000 children under five, who died today, according to UNICEF, from avoidable poverty-related causes. That's 10 million a year, and we don't help them. Well, the Darwinian can explain why we don't help them. We've evolved these responses, this compassion, in a face-to-face society. And if we see a child there, a starving child right there, we will help. We'll take the bread off our table and give it to them, because that's how we've evolved. But if we learn through the papers that there are children in need of assistance, maybe not starving, maybe just needing better health care or safe water elsewhere in the world, most of us don't help. Christian or non-Christian, most of us don't help. And that's unfortunate, I think. I think it's contrary to the morality we should hold, but it's quite in accordance with what you would expect from a Darwinian account. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not possible for us to do more and help, and to act more morally than you might expect a Darwinian primate. Might expect, but not incompatibly with it. Because we can, for example, think and reason and put ourselves in the position of others. We have evolved to have a capacity to reason. That's been very useful to us in surviving in a whole lot of complex situations, and perhaps explains why we are so successful as a species in populating this planet. But the capacity to reason also makes it possible for us to think and to say, well, look, there's someone who's hungry or cold or thirsty. That must feel to them pretty much like it feels to me when I'm hungry, cold or thirsty. And if at little cost to me, little risk of my survival, I can help them, why not? Makes, you know, accords with this compassion, something that we can, I think, reason our way to. And I don't think it needs religious inspiration. I think you can reach that through philosophical reasoning, as many philosophers have done throughout history, not all of them Christians, and not all of them even, Dinesh, influenced by Christians, because some of them existed before Christianity. For example, the Chinese philosopher Mencius, who lived about 300 years before Christianity, has a document in which he recounts visiting the kingdom of King Luai and finding that people were starving, and he upbraids the king because his granaries are full and the people are starving. And he says, you say it's the season. You say it's a bad year. You know, crops were bad this year. To blame the year when your granaries are full for starving, Mencius says, is like saying it wasn't me, like the murderer saying, it wasn't me who killed him, it was the knife. So we have this compassion. We have this ethic preceding Christianity. We have it also, as I said, in non-Christian religions. We have it in Buddhism, which incidentally is an atheist religion. We have it in many other thoughts in philosophers. We have it, say, in Marcus Aurelius, the idea of universal citizenship of the world. 1 minute already. Okay, so it exists, and it's not only Christian. Now, let me just say a brief word about the claim that atheism is responsible for the mass murders of history. Certainly some mass murderers have been atheists, no question. Atheists are no better than other people. But firstly, some of the greatest mass murderers of recent times have been cheered on by the Christians. I sort of have a personal anecdote that feels this, because my parents were Jews in Vienna when Hitler marched in to occupy Austria. And they remember that the Archbishop of Vienna rang the church bells in celebration as the Nazis marched in. And when Hitler called a phony referendum, on whether Austrians wish to merge with Germany, the Archbishop urged a yes vote. What also in the catalogue of murderers, along with junior league atheists like Pol Pot, what happened to Ante Pavelic, the founder of the Croatian Ustasha, who was responsible for murdering 500,000 Serbs and about 100,000 Jews and Gypsies in Croatia during the war? He doesn't seem to get a mention. Sadly, atrocities like this are not unique to atheism. They are part of what can happen to human beings in terrible circumstances.
Dinesh D'Souza.
In thinking about morality, let me begin first of all with a couple of clarifications. First of all, on this issue of caring for others and the rich and the poor, a sociologist named Arthur Brooks published a book a few months ago called Who Really Cares? It's a study of compassion, and it looks at a whole body of data on who cares for strangers, who gives time, who gives money. He divides American society into four groups. Religious conservatives, religious liberals, secular conservatives, secular liberals, self-described. And then he looks at the proportion of their income and time that they give to charity, particularly to strangers. He concludes that the group that does the most by far, many times by a factor of two over the last group, is religious conservatives. The group that does the second most is religious liberals. The group that does the third most is secular conservatives. And the group that does the least, which happens to have the most, is secular liberals. In other words, he shows, for example, that a poor religious conservative living in Oklahoma, making $30,000 a year, gives more, not only proportionately, but in real terms, than a secular liberal living in San Francisco, earning twice as much. Now, this is empirical fact, and what it seems to suggest is that instead of making broad generalizations about the rich, we've got to realize that most rich people in our society are secular. And so I agree with Peter Singer. They do too little, and they do too little in part because they are too secular. Now, let's talk for a moment about Darwin. There are two possible evolutionary bases for morality. The first, in a sense, is the idea of the shared gene. The idea here would be that a mom who jumps into a burning car to save her two children trapped inside is not just doing a wonderful, unselfish morality. She's actually trying to make sure her genes make it into the next generation. Morality is seen as a form of extended genetic selfishness. The other motive, which Peter Singer alluded to, can be called reciprocal altruism, which can be summed up, you be nice to me, and I'll be nice to you. The businessman, for example, who flatters his customer, not because he loves the guy or is being a great, wonderful human being, but because he wants the guy to come back and buy more. In other words, his morality is ultimately self-interested. And I would argue that taken together, these two Darwinian explanations can account for about 5% of what we call morality. But they don't account for most of it. For example, let's say I step into a bus. A 90-year-old woman hobbles on, and I get up and give my seat. What's my motive? Genetic selfishness? She's not nothing to me. She's not my grandmom. Is it tit for tat? I basically say, I better give her my seat because next week I want her seat. No. I'm just trying to be a nice guy. Or I give blood. Or I die for my country, or Mother Teresa on the streets of Calcutta. Even Richard Dawkins, in his book, The Selfish Gene, the most thorough discussion of this, says at the end of it very clearly, he says, pure altruism has no Darwinian foundation. In fact, he goes on to argue that we should, in a sense, be altruistic and rebel, he says, against our genes. We should, in a sense, invent unselfishness in you might say, revolt against our genetic background. So even the prime champion of evolutionary psychology in this area denies that morality can be seen as a mere spin-off of evolution. I want to now, very briefly, contest this notion raised by Peter Singer. It's a very bizarre type of argument, by the way. He focused so much of his opening statement on the problem of evil. Not really the problem of evil, the problem of suffering. Because he said, I know, if people do bad things, that can be attributed to free will. But what about natural disasters? What about tsunamis? What about hurricanes? Essentially, his mode of argument was this, and that is essentially, can we have morality without God, the subject of our debate? There is suffering in the world, therefore there is no God, therefore we can't have morality without God. We must have secular morality. Now, what I want to ask is it true that the existence of natural evil disproves the existence of God? I want to suggest, first of all, that even if all this natural evil existed, it might call into question the nature of God, but it would in no way call into question the existence of God. It's a little bit like this. Let's say I say my dad is a wonderful, kind, compassionate guy. And then I run into a terrible problem in life. I turn to my dad, will you help me? And he won't. Do I say, I've concluded from this, Dad, that you simply don't exist? No. I would say, Dad, I thought you were a great guy, and now I've got to reassess my opinion of you. But the existence of natural evil, my point is, says absolutely nothing about the existence of God. I finally want to raise a problem in the very little time I have left, and that is that Darwinism and evolution does not just have a problem accounting for good. How can we have morality? It has an even bigger problem accounting for evil. And here's why. There is evil, of course, in the animal kingdom. A lion may chase down and ruthlessly kill an antelope. But the evil is confined. It is confined, you may say, to the domain of self-interest. The lion wants his dinner, and his brutality is aimed at getting it. But it stops there. Have you ever seen a lion that wanted to, let us say, wipe out the entire antelope population of the earth? Never. But in humans, we do. In other words, for human beings, it is not only great good, but great evil, another moral fact in the world that can't be denied. And what is the evolutionary explanation for that? I ask Peter Singer. Thank you very much.
We're at the part of the program where our speakers can ask questions of one another. Peter Singer will begin with 5 minutes for cross-examination with short and pithy responses from Dinesh D'Souza.
Thank short, you. Pithy, and devastating.
Thank you. So I'd like you to just say briefly what exactly you think it is that we can't have if there is no God, because I haven't seen you say that. I haven't seen you in terms of the three things that I set out, but there's no concept of good, or that we wouldn't know what good is, or that we wouldn't be motivated to do it. I haven't seen what you've said, maybe a bit more or the less of the last, but it seems to be rather the sort of weak view that, well, Christians are more likely to be inspired to do good. But that, even if that's true, it surely doesn't defend the idea that there can't be morality without God. Just we might, if you're right, have a bit more of it if we have people who believe in God.
Right, and I certainly don't mean to suggest that morality derives from Christian scriptures. For example, when I read the Ten Commandments, it wasn't as if I said, wow, stealing is wrong. I never knew that before. Killing is wrong. Unbelievable. I already knew that before I read those commandments. So the point here is that morality, you might say, is stamped on our human nature by God. That's why it doesn't surprise me that even the pre-Christians had, you might say, I'm just saying that even their moral sense has a transcendental foundation. So you're asking me, why do I say it is transcendental? Is that what you're getting at?
Well, no, I guess perhaps you answered the question. I want to say whether you really believe that there can't be morality without God. And if I understood you correctly, you're saying, no, I don't really believe that. So in a sense, you're conceding, at least as far as the question is concerned, maybe this is like a debating point and I don't want to just stick with that, but you are conceding that there can be morality without God. Is that correct?
No, we're talking about two different things. One is the specific historical legacy of Christianity. And I'm saying certain institutions and values that we value in the West that have to some degree now been exported worldwide. For example, the idea that slavery is inconceivable. That is the distinctive legacy of Christianity. It's not all religion, it's not God, it is a particular Christian conception of God. Then I'm making a separate point and saying, if you will, that there is embedded within us a moral law That it's embedded in you as much as me. It doesn't matter that you're an atheist and I'm a Christian. It is embedded in both of us, a moral law that we acknowledge as authoritative and in a sense governing our actions. And I'm saying that that moral law cannot exist without a moral lawgiver. It doesn't have any, not only adequate, it doesn't have any real Darwinian explanation at all.
So there is, despite the fact that many people do these terrible things, they still have within them, you're saying, this moral law, which they acknowledge as authoritative, but don't follow.
Exactly. Consider right? Thomas Jefferson. He had 200 slaves, and he never freed a single one of them. That's because he benefited from it. The selfish Darwinian part of his nature benefited from slavery. At the same time, he knew, as I would argue, virtually every Southern slaveholder knew that there is something wrong and tyrannical about this, but you may say they wrestled with their consciences and won.
Right. So, in a way, we describe the same phenomenon, but slightly differently. I think this is actually really interesting, and this is exactly one of the kind of points you want to get out here. Because I would say about Jefferson that he knew that slavery was wrong because he could recognize that the slaves were people like him, who had needs like him, you know, who wanted to be with their families, but slavery sold the children off and so on. And he recognized, this is his rational capacities, recognized that he would not want that in his own case and that he couldn't really defend it. I don't see why you need to think that this capacity to recognize that has to be a kind of divine spark within us. I think I can give a purely natural account of it.
Well, you don't see, but Jefferson wouldn't agree with you, because when Jefferson, a man of the Enlightenment, a man of science, sat down to find out and to say, what is the source for rights? He was thinking of such rights as the equality of all men. Now, he could have said, the equality of rights is rooted in our reason. The equality of rights is rooted in the Enlightenment. I get it from Hume, I get it from Epictetus, and so on. But when Jefferson, this man of the Enlightenment, and perhaps the least orthodox of all the American founders, sat down to list the source of rights, inalienable rights, he could think of only one, and that's the Creator. So if all these other sources were available to him, why did he mention none of them?
Well, you know, I think if you want to win over the support of Americans, it was probably true in 1776, as it's true today, that mentioning God is going to help you.
But if that is true, then the most famous statement of Jefferson, you might say, is a Machiavellian lie. In other words, it is ultimately, when Jefferson sat down to say, what is the basis of inalienable rights? There aren't any. And Jefferson, merely for prudential or Machiavellian reasons, said, I'm going to put God out there so the rest of the people believe it. This would strip all the philosophical content out of the Declaration of Independence, remove the uniqueness of the American idea. It seems to me that even if you're right that there is an element of playing to the crowd, it does a grave disservice to Jefferson to take perhaps his most famous formulation and simply reduce it, if you will, to Obama-like cunning.
I was trying to keep politics out of this debate. But really, I mean, you know, actually, I have to say, you know, as a philosophical text, I don't think the Declaration, you know, gets us very far. But you can remove the Creator from it. You can just say, we believe these rights are self-evident. Now, then you have to examine, you know, why are some rights self-evident, why are not? And in fact, that's one of the unsatisfactory things of the rights tradition. But sorry, I'm not supposed to be making speeches, am I? No. Supposed to be asking you questions.
Maybe one more question.
One more question. Okay. So, well, let me ask you, since you did pick on my views as an example of some of the problems, let me, you know, I hold these views because I think there are real problems, and you seem to acknowledge that in terms of the separation that we make between humans and animals, and the fact we seem to think it's fine to confine billions of animals to, you know, appalling conditions in factory farms. I think actually that the religious traditions, and even specifically the Christian tradition, with its complete separation of humans and animals, is largely, or not largely, significantly responsible for this fact that we don't bring animals within the moral sphere. I don't see you defending that, and I do see it as a serious objection to the claim that Christianity is such an enlightened morality.
Well, I think that there is a very good reason that we make this distinction between the animals and us. and the reason can be discerned by turning on the Nature Channel. There you will see, for example, a gorilla move into the territory of another gorilla, bludgeon him with blows, grab the female gorilla, drag her screaming into his lair, rape her, and this is what we call the Nature Channel. This is perfectly acceptable and ordinary behavior. It is, you may say, doing what comes naturally. On the other hand, if someone came into my house, knocked me down, grabbed my wife, dragged her to his apartment, and raped her, I would assume that we would see a little bit of a moral difference. And this suggests that the principles of the animal kingdom cannot be automatically exported into human life without great cost.
30 seconds.
Well, to say that, what you responded to was not my position. My position is why we are prepared to inflict so much suffering on animals, not in a state of nature, but in our confined factory farms, without significant protests from Christianity.
I think that that cruelty is unjustified, and I'm going to, if I may, turn it around and take my time to ask questions. Let me begin for a moment with Jefferson for a moment, because you say that we don't need a transcendental foundation for the idea of equality, which is, by the way, an idea not only at the root of Jefferson's work, but I think you will agree of your work, the reason being that utilitarianism is based on the assumption that everyone's interest counts equally. So equality is its moral foundation. Now, Jefferson says that this equality is self-evident. I maintain it is not evident at all. On every measurable characteristic, strength, speed, size, intelligence, perhaps even moral character and moral behavior, it is evident that human beings are unequal. So I ask you, in what respect is it, arguing on the basis of reason alone, self-evident that there is this equality? What is its basis? Where does it come from?